Fade in.
Exterior. Interior.
Restaurant.
Bar. Club.
Day.
Night.
Action!
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to Restaurant Fiction. This is the podcast that reviews every single fictional restaurant, bar, and club in TV and film. Now, we have not yet reviewed every single fictional restaurant, bar, and club in TV and film. In fact, the amount of material we have, we feel, is everlasting because we feel that pretty much every single film or movie or flick, however you want to call it, or TV series has a food scene, has a bar scene, has even a club scene. And guess what? We are here to review it. And we will, and we are, and we do bring along a food aficionado or food culinary professional, or even just the ultimate fan to discuss, to dive, to really bring, say, 5% of the mythology of the creative project that you love to life. My name is Manas Rose. Now, how, for those of you listening for the first time or for the 79th time, because guess what? We have 79 episodes. How did this idea come to fruition? Well, personally, my story in Los Angeles starts in the kitchen. That's right. I was a cook and I belonged to some of, at least at the time, those trendy, you can argue if they are prominent or if they are great. That's neither here nor there. But at the time, they were trendy. They were hip restaurants of LA. One of them was Animal. The other was the Eleni Oyster Bar. Another one was Scarpetta. There was Mod. Had a hand in hotel kitchens. Had a hand in corporate kitchens as well. Even catering. Then I was taught how to write about food. I was taught by the late and the great Jonathan Gold, the Pulitzer Prize winning food critic, food writer for formerly the LA Weekly, then the LA Times before, unfortunately, he passed. I was also taught by the former food critic of Los Angeles Magazine. And of course, I read the and studied Craig Claiborne, one of the best food critics for the New York Times. And then I'm going to mispronounce her name, and I apologize. I am taking off my journalistic integrity hat to mispronounce names. Ruth Reichel. I believe it's Ruth Reichel. And I also read about M.K. Fisher and all of her food excursions. But to top it all off, more than being a cook and a food writer, I am a screenwriter. That's why I am in Los Angeles to begin with. And this is my love. I am combining all three of my loves out there. Writing about food and talking about food. Writing about TV and film. And then pretty much cooking. Pretty much the art of breaking bread. And I want to give you, the audience, and I'm picturing myself as an audience member, insight of how it is so important that when you watch, say, a TV show or a film out there, that even that slight 1 second scene of a couple of characters sipping coffee actually tells so much of the story that you are seeing. Whether that be a comedy, whether that be a drama, whether it be a Western, whether that be a silent film, the food scene, the act of breaking bread, the location of say that bar or that restaurant or even that club is so important. It's so important for the mythology. It is so important for the characters and is so important for the story. Is this my passion project? Sure. But even more than that, it is who I am. And I think out there, I think the whole goal of the human experience is to be one's authentic self. Now, this is part two. Part two of our chat with Michael Ruhlman. Now, who is Michael Ruhlman? Well, I have read his work. I have admired his work for some time. I actually personally first found out and heard about Michael Ruhlman by reading his books. He writes about his experience in helping create the French Laundry Cookbook with Thomas Keller in the late 90s. And also he wrote about his experience following and shadowing Chef Michael Simon before even Chef Michael Simon is the celebrity chef he is now, when Michael Simon was just putting Ohio on the map. And I also read about his experience cooking at the CIA, not the government spy agency CIA, but the Culinary Institute of America CIA. And of course, I saw him. He was occasionally showed up on one of Anthony Bourdain's shows, or for those who were in his inner circle, Tony Bourdain. I am not, so I'm going to call him Anthony. May you rest in peace. Now, Michael is on the podcast for part two. I guarantee it is awesome. It is a part two. It is, personally, the better half. Yes, I get to judge my own podcast, and I chose to split one episode into two because this second half, this ending, is fucking amazing. Now, we already reviewed Gusteau's in part one. So if you want to hear how Restaurant Fiction reviews the fictional restaurant from the Pixar film Ratatouille, Gusteau's, listen to part one. If you want a deeper insight of Gusteau's and Ratatouille, we actually talked with the production designer of the film. So circle back to the beginning episodes of Restaurant Fiction, and there's a little treat waiting for you. Mm-hmm. That's right. But that was the past. This is now. And we're chatting with the incredible, the articulate, the bright food author, food critic, just a plain great fiction and nonfiction badass writer, Michael Ruhlman.
Your gang, your editor, your publisher, your agent, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they give you an extravagantly paid writing assignment to create the Gusteau's La Ratatouille cookbook. What's your process? How are you going to go about it? What will be your working relationship with a chef?
I would go about it the way I go about these cookbooks that I write with chefs. I hang out in the restaurants. I spend time watching. I report from within the kitchen to get a sense of the soul of the place and the feel of the place and the mind of the chef. When I did the French Laundry cookbook with Thomas, I went out there and I lived in his house. And so I would hang out in the kitchens. I'd stand against the wall and take notes and take down quotes and ask him questions. So I report the cookbooks. Ultimately, I'm a journalist first. And that's how I would handle it. So I would have taken that bucket and mop that Remy uses, and I would have been washing the floors while watching people work. I would be mincing shallot if I could. There was a point when I was watching Grant Achatz, who would go on to create Alinea, as you know. And he was this god sweet kid who was on Fish Station and was a brilliant cook. And you know, I was telling Thomas about my, you know, I was saying, Thomas, when I was at the culinary, the reason how I got all this stuff is because I learned how to cook. And could you put me on Fish Station? And he said, don't even think about it. I was thinking about it, but he was absolutely right not to put me on Fish Station, because I would have gotten buried and I would have fucked up the food and that would have been the end. But I try and become a part of the place that I'm working in, whether it's a surgical operating room or a wooden boat shop, or especially a kitchen. I hang out in the kitchen, I watch and absorb and ask questions.
How would you deal with having a stage at Gusteau, Michael?
I probably would have dealt with it exactly the way Remy dealt with it. I would be a fuck up, is what I would do. I would try, I would cut myself, I would burn myself, and I'd get screamed at. And you get screamed at in French kitchens, and I would have had a hard time of it, I think. I eventually would have acquitted myself fine. People do it. I mean, Eric Repair did it. He had all kinds of screw-ups and became one of the most talented, revered chefs in the world. You can do it. It's just a matter of practice. It's just how long you are willing to put up with the abuse. For some people, the kitchen is the only place where they feel comfortable in the world. This is a world of misfits and hard work where professional kitchens operate on a level that no other workplace really operates in. You work incredibly hard. Deadlines are real. You don't say, you know, when the chef says ordering one braise or one lamb shank, you don't say, oh, sorry, I didn't get to that today. The way a construction worker who's working at a restaurant might say, sorry, we didn't get the tile in today. I know we said we would, but we didn't. You know, a kitchen is a world where it's divided into two people, two types of people. You either did what you said you were going to do, or you didn't do what you said you were going to do. You're that kind of person or the other kind of person. And you want to be a person who 100%, if you said you were going to do it, it got done, and people could rely on that. I like the reliance that people have on one another in a good kitchen. There's just so much about the kitchen that is valuable in the real world. Attention to deadlines, being clean, working together, being aware of all that's around you. There's kind of awareness that you need to have in the kitchen, certainly today's kitchen, a high-end kitchen, that I just really admire and I love. And I often tell people, and I believe this wholeheartedly, if everyone was forced, and you probably know this too, because you've been a cook, if the entire world had to learn how to cook first before they did anything, this world would operate in a much more efficient, fun way.
What's your favorite position in the kitchen brigade?
For some reason, in culinary school, I always got put on the grill station, and I grilled my whole life. I loved it, and I was good at it. So I was lucky to be put on it when I was in culinary school because I sort of had an innate sense, and I knew how to man a grill, and I was praised by the Ron DeSantis, the chef there, who saw how I was managing all the hot spots in the grill. And so I'm good at that. But in a French kitchen, the saucier is the sort of high man on the totem pole. So I would aspire to saucier. I'd be on the grill station looking at the saucier, wanting to be over there.
And if you had the opportunity to have a rat help you out on top of your head, would you do so?
Because I would probably need any help that I could get, I would welcome it. Certainly one as talented as that wonderful rat.
This is probably going to be a little different question. So looking back at your career, tell me about your favorite failure.
After I wrote The Making of Chef, I couldn't get any more books off the ground. We were quickly becoming broke again. And so I said, hey, I can cook. I'll get a job as a cook. I need a job. So I got a job at a fancy restaurant in Cleveland, a high-end French restaurant. And I was on the grill. So I was grilling steaks and salmon and lamb chops. And one night, everybody, and I cooked on a fire grill. So, and I fed fireplace logs in this big grill. On one night, everybody was ordering the steak. I think every single mother effing table in the restaurant ordered steak. And it was, you know, it would come in, you know, it'd be, you know, Mark, the chef would be saying, ordering. So it's two steaks medium well, two steaks rare, three steaks mid rare. And I'd be calling them back. And by, you know, after about an hour of this, every time an order came in and he'd say steak, the other chefs in the line just laughed because they knew I was getting hammered and they kind of liked it. It's not a great kitchen environment. I didn't like the, no one stepped in to help because they weren't cooking. They were just sort of twiddling their thumbs. Their stations weren't buried. I was buried. I had steaks everywhere across my station. I had steaks in every conceivable place waiting to be fired. I had the grill loaded. Paul, the sous chef, said, Michael, your fire's going out. Feed the fire. I was so busy. I was doing 360s, so busy. I couldn't even feed the fire. It was absolutely humiliating. This is what is called getting your ass handed to you. It was a miserable, humiliating night. It was so bad. I'll never forget it. Never forget it. It was so bad that I just vowed that would never happen again. I will never let that happen again. And I did. I did. I was crushed at the end of the evening. Sous chef Paul, he saw that I was humiliated, and he sweetly came up to me and says, "Hey, we're going out to the bar after work. Do you want to join us?" And so it's nice that I didn't screw them up so badly that I was like, "Oh, who is this loser here who can't keep his fire lit for the grill to cook his steaks?" It motivated me to never let I came in and I hustled from that day on. You know, I moved it up one more level of hustle to push. And again, I love that about the work of the kitchen. I was reporting on Alinea in its early days, and the chef ran out of bacon for one of the dishes that Grant wanted. And he just looked at the chef and said, "Why do you lie to yourself? How can you not have bacon? Why did you lie to yourself so that you don't have any bacon?" And I went up to him 15 years later. I said, "Pincus, remember the bacon?" And he just closed his eyes and shook his head and then nodded his head. He said, "Of course, I'll never forget that bacon." These moments on the line are really powerful and they shape you. It's crazy. It's crazy. But they do. So I'm not the only one who's had that kind of experience, but it changed me. As you said, it was a disastrous night, but it changed the way I worked. I'll always be grateful for that. And I'll never forget that. I put it in my little YA novel too. I put that experience in there. You know, writing and cooking, it's all intertwined for me.
You know, and even when you write about the real prominent chefs say like the Thomas Kellers, the Michael Simons, for me, I love when I learn about when their asses were handed to them. So like in the late 90s with Michael, I think it was Lola, but just like one night he was in the weeds. And that was, I mean, and it was like, wow, even Michael Simon was in the weeds. Or, you know, I remember.
That's the scene that I wrote in Soul of a Chef that you're referring to. And it was crazy. It was amazing. He slammed. There were tickets all everywhere. Everyone was seated. Everyone ordered at once. There's tickets flying above the stove. And I remember he just threw six saute pans down on burners. And I said, afterwards, I said, "Michael, why did you do that?" He said, "Because I didn't know where I was, but I knew that when I figured out what it was, I wanted hot pans." That was the only thing he knew. He was deep in the weeds.
Wow. But, you know, it actually draws even the reader and the audience in because it's relatable, because then it's like, well, hey, even so-and-so has a fuck up or is a mistake every once in a while.
If you're a chef and you didn't have that, then you weren't working hard enough. Every great chef had his moments, her moments. Every time, every chef I know has a story. There's even books about about disastrous kitchen nights.
What kinds of stories stick with you?
Stories where something happens. Stories that have consequences. My first writing teacher, Reynolds Price, a great Southern writer, said, you know, started off our first story class. It's like, what is a story? Is the king died a story? And he answered, no, I don't think it is. But is this a story? The king died and the queen died of grief. That is a story. Something happens. And then as a result of that, something else more important happens. So that's a story to me. That's the most brutal deconstruction of what a story is. But something has to happen. I love those writers who surprise you on every page, like Flannery O'Connor, who surprises you when one of the characters steals another character's wooden leg, for instance, in Good Country People, I believe that is. We all know stories. It's gossip. It's what you tell your friends. It's what you go to the bar and have a martini and you say, "God, you'll never believe what happened today." That's where story lies. And story fail to appreciate the importance of story. Story is the dominant sound of our lives. Human beings, we're storytelling creatures. This is how we understand the world, through story. Story is more important than love. It's more important than shelter. It's second only to food and water. Too many millions live without love or shelter. No one lives without story, whether it's the vast ramblings of this psychotic homeless guy on a bench, or the story of our day when we get home from work and what happened, honey. This story is fundamental to Homo sapiens. We're also the only animal that cooks. And I think they're fundamentally related. I started cooking about the same time I started writing stories in fifth grade. We even tell ourselves stories in our sleep, you know, to keep from being bored, I think to keep us occupied. Who knows why we dream? But we know that if we're prevented from telling ourselves stories while we sleep, we go mad. We're not sustainable. So stories are fundamental to us. Cooking is fundamental to us. And I sort of live my life recognizing these two key facts.
You're now going to mesh the two. How important is the story behind the food you cook, talk about, and write about?
That's interesting. You know, nowadays, everything sort of has a story. It's become a marketing gimmick. Every company, every food source has its story. And they're important if they're genuine. If they're not genuine, people pick up on it and they know right away. I like the story of Rumi Spice about this woman who was a veteran of the war in Iran who came back and started a spice company, first with saffron, which she saw over there. That's a fascinating story. When I was doing the last cookbook with Thomas, he wanted the story of his purveyors. He wanted to know how Skip Kennan, who supplies perfect oysters for his Oysters and Pearls that I was talking about. And I went to see this guy out on the raft where they haul up the oysters. He wanted Skip's story told because they're individual important. The story of the woman who makes the butter. These are all crazy obsessed people and they're fascinating. You don't do this work because there's a promise of money, but there's certainly no guarantee of it. You've got to really love what you're doing in this world in order to do it. And I think that those stories are important, which is why he wanted the story of his purveyors who gave him the food to be in his book. So that, you know, it's important, those stories of the food.
When do you know as an artist, as a creative, when to put the pen down? Like when done is done. No more drafts. I've done the best I could do.
That's a really good question, especially for me, because I sent Making of a Chef off because I had to. I didn't know if it was any good. I did the same thing with Soul of a Chef. I didn't know if it's any good. It's a great question. I think the best answer to that is, can't remember who said it, but a great old writer said, I know I'm done when I spend all day taking a comma out of a sentence and then at the end of the day, putting it back in. Then I'm done. Then I know I can't do anymore. So there's that. But part of it is deadline. Part of it is just, I've been writing for 30 years. I've been writing my whole life. So I've been writing since fifth grade, but I've been writing professionally for 30 years and reading for all that time. So you know a good story and you have your readers. My wife, who's a novelist, Ann Hood, she'll read my stuff and say, this is good, or no, this is a mess. You have to have readers you trust because you can't see it. Certainly after you finish something, it's still sort of steaming and hot. And you don't know if it's a steaming pile of, you know what, or if it's going to solidify into something valuable. You need other eyes on it. So I rely on other readers to know that I'm on the right, at least on the right track. If not, oh, this is great, or this is terrible. You need to work on it. Here's why.
What does the Michael Ruhlman New York food tour look like? And then you can even mention Rhode Island if you would like.
Yeah, my wife is from Rhode Island. We have a place in Rhode Island. We're now living in New York in the West Village, which is such a great food place. We love it here. The food tour here is the food is so diverse here that I've been wanting to take a food tour in my own neighborhood. It's so diverse. I've grown to love food tours. Every city I go to, we get a food tour. The first thing, because it helps you navigate the city. It shows you where all the great food is. You get resources from the guide. I've written about it for the New York Times, the importance of food tours, which I poo-pooed because I was like, I know everything and blah, blah, blah. But she gave me a food tour in Athens and it was absolutely transformative. And it showed me the city, same in Lisbon, same in Porto, same in Paris. We just went. And in Paris, it was great because we had a croissant, but it was the best croissant in the city. We had pâté en croûte, the best pâté en croûte in the city. I mean, there's pâté en croûte everywhere there, but we had the best. So that was fascinating. So I urge people, do food tours. If you like food and you like eating and care about it, it's a great way to know a city. So I would say, if you're in my neighborhood in New York, get a New York food tour. if you're in Rhode Island, I would take you to, Rhode Island's crazy. They have things like cabinets. That's a milkshake. They have so many great unusual things like New York systems, which are hot dogs with like chili on them. So in Rhode Island, there's so many cool things, Johnny cakes and New York systems and cabinets and Dell's lemonade. And it's really an unusual, I should write about this. It's really an unusual and wonderful food town. There's also great restaurants there. Persimmon and New Rivers are two of our favorites. So there's lovely, quirky, wonderful restaurants there. But if I were doing a food, I could do a food tour in Rhode Island, but because it's simple and quirky and I'd follow what I cared about and what I loved and what's unique to the area. But I would actually have to get Calvin Trillin to take me around and show me New York City food, because there's so much here, and it's so fascinating and fun.
What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
I love a peanut butter and cabbage sandwich for lunch on a multigrain bread. It's delicious. I was writing about Grant Achatz at Alinea, and I told him about the sandwich. He said, "What?" I said, "It's great." And he said, "Really?" And I said, "Well, think about it, Grant. You've had celery with peanut butter on it. It's the same sort of crunchy vegetable with a peanut butter." And they said, "Huh, interesting." So peanut butter and cabbage sandwich is a great lunch, and I want everybody to try it. Slab of cabbage, raw cabbage, and peanut butter. You know, some of my friends think it's whack, but I love it.
This is Plugs. Where can people find you, get your work, read your work, all of that? The floor is yours. You can advertise whatever you want to advertise for upcoming current projects. The floor is yours.
My website is ruhlman.com, R-U-H-L-M-A-N.com. All my books are there. They're all available on Amazon, and I'm very Googleable. Follow me on Instagram, R-U-H-L-M-A-N. And that's that. I love being in touch with readers. I like the connection. I sit in my little tiny studio apartment in the West Village and write all day. So I'm alone most of the time. So I like interacting with readers. So please feel free to contact me, email me through my site. I get all that email and I will respond.
Michael, thank you, thank you, thank you. You are welcome back to Restaurant Fiction at any time. It was a joy to have you a part of this program. All right, for all of you listeners, all of you fans that want to know more about Michael and his work, well, first and foremost, go to his website, www.ruhlman, that is spelled R-U-H-L-M-A-N.com. There you can find all of his books, whether it is they are the books that he has authored himself or has co-authored or has done a collaboration with. I mean, personally, our favorites are the Book of Schmaltz, Love Song to a Forgotten Fat, or honestly, The Soul of a Chef, which really, I mean, the title says it all and speaks of his time getting to know a young at the time chef, Michael Simon, and a young at the time, and of course, they're always young, young at heart at least, and a young at the time, Thomas Keller. Anyway, need I say more? They are awesome, but he has a plethora of books out there. Also, follow him on the gram. He loves his fans. He loves his audience. It is at Ruhlman, R-U-H-L-M-A-N. As for us with Restaurant Fiction, well, you found us, whether that was on iTunes, whether that was on Spotify, on Audible, on iHeartRadio, wherever you find your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with me personally, the email is monis@restaurantfiction.com. Let us know what you loved, what you hated. You have a beef. Well, guess what? We know a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy to send you down the LA River. Yeah, that's neither here nor there. Anyway, welcome to 2023. Thank you, Michael. And until next time, keep it real, keep it fresh, and always keep it on the flip side.
Cut to.
Exterior. Interior.
restaurant?
Bar.